you want to know something?
One thing I've discovered, dead people usually stay dead.
And you know that we didn't actually need the advances in medical technology and science from the 19th and 20th centuries to teach us that. People back in the first century knew that dead people stay dead. And it wasn't the apostles, it wasn't the disciples, it wasn't the women who accompanied Jesus from Galilee who certified that Jesus was dead. It was the Roman centurion. He declared that Jesus was dead. Now, it was the Romans' job to put people to death, so they knew how to do it. It was their business. It was their normal way of doing things. So when a Roman centurion certifies that a person was dead, then he was dead. Now, I think the first thing we need to come to terms with in terms of looking at the resurrection, in looking at this magnificent story that Luke gives us in chapter 24, it's the first of three stories. Some have said it's like the first part of a three-stage symphony. The second story is that beautiful story of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. And then finally, Jesus appears to all of the 11. This one is for the women. But they go looking to bring spices to the tomb of a dead man. This is an image. It's called the body of the dead Christ in the tomb by Hans Holbein. He's called the younger because, strangely, his father, Hans Holbein, was called the elder. Born in Germany in 1498, so the late 15th century. This particular painting is quite massive. It's larger than life size. It's more than 2 meters long. And it details with gruesome accuracy, very humanistic, just the elements of the dead Christ, painted in 1522. When the great author, Fyodor Dostoevsky, saw this poem, he fainted. So overwhelmed was he by the reality of this painting. And it's actually in 3D. You don't quite get that from the image. So you're almost seeing on the wall of the museum. It's now in a museum in Basel in Switzerland. But you see the sense of the recess in the wall where in the body of Christ was laid. Just to give you a bit more detail about the brutality that is evident that Hans Holbein was able to elicit in this. Just detail of his feet and his hands, bruised and battered and beaten. This is not a man who would raise from the dead. When the women went back to the tomb on the first day of the week, when they went back there before dawn, they were expecting to find that. They were expecting to find the dead body of their beloved Lord. That's the first thing. In order for us to understand what this great mystery is that lies at the heart of the resurrection, we need to look at what Luke does in Luke 23 and 24. There are a number of things that Luke was so careful to tell us at the end of the crucifixion scene. We had it last Sunday when we read the Passion story from the Gospel of Luke on Palm Sunday. The first was that declaration of the centurion guard. Not just that Jesus was dead, but also that he was an innocent man. He was the victim, not a villain. So Jesus is certified by the witness of the centurion. Then Luke tells us that the whole crowd of people were there, and they saw all that happened, and after Jesus had died, they went home sad and forlorn, beating their breasts. So forsaken were they by the sight of the dead Messiah. Finally, there was the group of disciples, the women who had accompanied Jesus on the way from Galilee, and then the other disciples who watched from a distance. They witnessed all that had happened in the passion, the suffering, and the death of Jesus. And then, finally, of course, Joseph of Arimathea comes, and he takes down the body of Jesus from the cross. And accompanied by the women, with the permission of Pilate, he takes the body of Jesus to a new tomb. And again, that's significant. Luke sets out all of these amazing details as he gives us the story, the end of Luke 23. All of them are necessary for us to understand the power of the resurrection story that Luke gives us. Luke 24, the first 12 verses. The next thing we need to remember, although there's a great variety of ways of burying people in the ancient Near East, the way that we're told today in the Gospel according to Luke, clearly they were preparing for two-stage burial. So the first stage is you take the body and you place it in a tomb. Normally that's just a cave. It's either natural or constructed. And in this case, it would be, it's a new tomb, hasn't been used before. So there would be a number of shelves, just like in that painting of Hans Holbein. And so you would place the body in that shelf, and you would wrap it in a shroud, and you would fill it with spices. So when the women were going back on that first day of the week, they were simply going back to add extra spices, because the body would decompose over the next few months. And then the second stage was that you would reverently collect all of the bones after the flesh and all the muscles and all the organs had decomposed and the bones were left. You would carefully gather them together and place them into a bone box, an ossuary. And then finally, the remains would be buried a second time. So today when we go for a burial, that's the end of the road. But in the ancient Near East, it was generally a two-stage process, a two-stage that allowed that mourning to happen over an extended period. So when the women went to that tomb, the first thing is, of course, they knew where the tomb was. They were always going back. So when they accompanied Joseph of Arimathea to the tomb, they knew which one it was. Anyone who tells you that they may have mistaken which tomb it was just doesn't understand that culture. The second thing is, of course, we're told that it's a new tomb. So there's no other corpses, no other bodies that are present in that tomb. Jesus is the only one there. So the women didn't mistake, you know, didn't go into the wrong tomb or didn't go in and say, oh, that shelf is empty, therefore he's risen. Everything was empty. And all that was left are the burial cloths. The shroud is left. And of course, again, that's a sign that the other thing that they might have suspected is that perhaps grave robbers had come. But what grave robber in their right mind would unwrap the body of someone who'd just been crucified by the Romans, beaten and bloody, battered? They wouldn't. So they see this sign, but they're still dumbfounded, still confused, because they're not expecting the resurrection. No one expected, as a first century Jew, that Jesus Christ was going to be the one single example of someone who would raise to the dead before the general resurrection. Yes, they expected that. Yes, they anticipated that all of creation would be raised again in one great glorious act of the power of God. But they never expected that one single person, one single individual would be raised to new life before all of the others. So this is at the heart of what it means to be Christian. This is at the heart of our own faith and our own expectation. That this is the central claim of Christianity. That when the women went there on that day, they were totally bamboozled, totally overwhelmed. And then when the angels appeared, they began to have some sense of faith. Like women across the centuries, they remembered. They remembered what Jesus had said, unlike the other apostles. Peter, of course, at least takes the time and the energy to go and investigate it. The others simply dismissed all that as foolish, idle talk. But Peter goes, and Peter sees, but he doesn't believe. He goes back amazed. They're the three options that are available to us. That's the three possibilities that are given for us. How will we respond? What will our response be? Will we be like so many today, atheists among them, who simply dismiss all that we believe, everything that happened in the first century, a stupid, idle talk, and say nothing that happened, all this talk of miracles and resurrection, is just first century mythology? Or will we be like Peter? Will we go to the tomb and see things with our own eyes, but be amazed and bewildered, but nothing else? Or like the women, will we come to believe? Will we realize the strength of the evidence that's presented before us? And will we take that step and allow this to move me and fulfill me and bring me to that next stage on the journey? These are the choices. These are the options that we're invited to make. One of those choices our own. Hopefully, of course, to move to number three. To move to that sense of believing in the power of all that happened. Believing in the power of what Jesus did for us. That we can be changed and transformed. And through us, we can renew the world.